This 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. Defense Department says U.S. warplanes launched strikes against Islamic State targets around the Libyan coastal city of Sirte, as requested by the North African country's UN-backed National Unity Government. Peter Cook is a Pentagon spokesman.
Today, at the request of Libya's Government of National Accord, the United States conducted precision airstrikes against ISIL targets in Sirte, Libya, to support GNA-affiliated forces seeking to defeat ISIL in its primary stronghold in Libya.
He said one strike hit an IS tank and had directly challenged GNA-aligned forces and discriminately targeted civilians. Another strike hit two IS vehicles. Cook also said it's the start of a sustained campaign to back Libyan forces as they conduct operations against Islamic State. Meanwhile, the head of the Libyan Presidency Council, Fayez Sarraj, said the council decided to request direct support from the U.S. He said it's to be done in close coordination with the council. The U.S. defense spokesman said the strikes will continue to target IS forces in Sirte to enable the GNA to, quote, make a decisive strategic advance and help deny IS a safe haven in Libya from which it could attack the U.S. and its allies. A Nigerian commission Monday found that the army killed nearly 350 people from a minority Shia Muslim sect last December and called for the prosecution of those involved. The judicial inquiry said the army used excessive force in 2 days of violence in Zaria when sect followers blocked the road used by a military convoy carrying the chief of the army staff. The army says the protesters were trying to assassinate General Tutar Burakai. The rights group Amnesty International accused the military of deliberately shooting dead the Shia followers of cleric Ibrahim Zakzaki, who remains in detention. This is VOA News. A Russian military helicopter was shot down Monday in northwest Syria, killing all five on board, including two officers and three crew members. Lieutenant General Sergei Rutskoy called it a terrorist act. He said the helicopter was returning from a humanitarian mission, providing food and medicine to residents of Aleppo when it crashed in rebel-held Idlib province. The crash occurred as rebels launched a new assault on government-held districts in the embattled northern Syrian city. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in a joint appearance with his Colombian counterpart in Washington, acknowledged Monday the target date of August 1st, set to get the Syrian government and opposition into negotiations on the country's future, came and went with no sign of such talks.
Almost all of the time, from the moment of the announcement of the target date until today, has been consumed by trying to get a cessation of hostilities in place that is meaningful. And that is precisely what we are engaged in right now. There are obviously great concerns about what is happening on the ground there. We all share them. And there is a situation where Assad regime attacks and conducts offensive operations, but Nusra, which doesn't want a cessation, also attacks and goes into offensive operations.
Kerry called on Russia and Damascus to refrain from conducting such operations. He said the evidence so far, whether Moscow or Syria, can break the cycle of violence is troubling. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei Monday renewed his criticism of last year's international nuclear agreement, accusing the U.S. of failing to keep its side of the bargain. Speaking in Tehran, the Iranian spiritual leader said 6 months after going into effect, there's been no tangible benefit of the deal on the people's lives. He said sanctions relief has been gradual and hope for foreign investment has yet to materialize. Venezuela's National Election Council Monday said the opposition has successfully collected the necessary 1% of voter signatures in every state in their drive to recall President Nicolas Maduro. The opposition had to collect 200,000 valid signatures before a referendum could be held. The council, however, asked for an investigation into possible fraud involving hundreds of those signatures. Typhoon Nita, which brought fierce winds and torrential rains to Hong Kong Tuesday, moved northwest into southern China. The storm has forced the cancellation of flights, closed Hong Kong's stock market, schools, and many businesses. Kenyan police say they, along with U.S. anti-narcotics agents, seized nearly 100 kilograms of cocaine at the country's main seaport, Mombasa, in a container from Brazil. A British national, two Kenyans are being questioned. The containers were destined for Uganda. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's Minister of Agriculture has resigned.
I went to the cabinet to implement the peace agreement. If the peace agreement has died, I have no moral justification to continue in that government.
Lama Cole is South Sudan's former Minister of Agriculture. South Africa's ruling African National Congress faces a big test in tomorrow's crucial local elections. Benonai Yure will tell us why he wants to be the next president of Liberia. The Secretary General of Zimbabwe's War Veterans Association has been arrested. And why did tens of thousands of people in Ethiopia's Amhara region take to the streets on Sunday?
The people in Wolkai, Agade, they say that, rightly, that they are Amharas and not Tigrayans, so they should not be incorporated in the Tigray region.
Getachew Metefara is professor of political science at Morgan State University in the state of Maryland. And we'll look at police reform in Ferguson, Missouri, 2 years after the police killing of African-American Michael Brown. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's Minister of Agriculture in the transitional government of national unity has resigned. Lam Akol says he left President Salva Kiir's cabinet because of what he calls ethnocentric policies. Akol says President Kiir's decisions are influenced by a tribal group in South Sudan. He also says the Kiir administration is on the verge of collapse.
Because the transitional government national unity, as we know it, does not exist anymore. You know, the peace agreement has been killed, and therefore with it, all the institutions of the peace agreement. What happened in Juba last month clearly indicated that the peace agreement has collapsed. If the security arrangement collapsed, then it means that there is no peace agreement.
And from your own reading, what exactly happened? We hear that there was a shooting at the presidential palace, and then later on, fighting ensued between forces loyal to Riek Machar and South Sudan Army. What was the reason for this fighting?
You know, from the very beginning, the president did not accept the peace agreement, so he has always been violating it. For example, he created 28 states instead of the 10 that are stipulated in the peace agreement. He has been obstructing the security arrangements. For example, he did not withdraw his forces in Juba. There were problems about cantonment in Equatoria and Bahr el Ghazal and all this. What happened in the first week of July was a series of provocations against the IO, and then at the end it ended into a conflict that resulted in the first vice president being driven out of the capital. So if you don't have the first vice president, then who is the next partner in the peace agreement?
You are leaving your position at a very crucial time in South Sudan where the international community plus aid agencies are saying the population is food insecure. There is a looming catastrophe. Why are you leaving your post at a time when the people of South Sudan need you most?
I don't think so, because, you know, without security, you can never do anything. The country now, with the peace agreement dead, means unless the international force comes quickly, the other option is that the war will escalate and there will be more insecurity, and there can never be any room for doing anything. I went to the cabinet to implement the peace agreement. If the peace agreement has died, I have no moral justification to continue in that government.
Do you have any evidence that the violence that erupted in the first week of July in Juba was premeditated and planned? Is there any evidence?
Yes, I do.
Can you share with us some of your thoughts on this?
No, I don't think so now, because it will not be useful to discuss it publicly.
Dr. Lam, this is not the first time you're leaving your country. You were there, you came out, you went to Cairo in exile. After staying in exile for some time, you came back to Juba. Are you going to go back to Juba again?
Of course, Juba is the capital of South Sudan, and I will definitely go. But the issue is under what conditions? Right now, Juba is not a place to stay because there is no security in Juba. There is no space. You know that Alfred Taban is under arrest. Another journalist called Michael Christopher is also under arrest. And there is no space for political freedom or freedom of the press. And there is no space for peaceful political opposition. So if there is nothing like that, what do I do in Juba?
Lam Akol is South Sudan's former Minister of Agriculture and the leader of the Democratic Change Party. He was speaking with John Tanza from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. South Africans are voting tomorrow, Wednesday, in crucial local elections that could upset the country's political balance of power for the first time in two decades. The ruling African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, is losing its historic base. The poor and disadvantaged, viewers Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Peter Rafferty grew up in the poor Johannesburg township of El Dorado Park, which was then restricted to mixed-race residents. The long-ruling African National Congress promised to bring widespread equality and prosperity. The ANC, now led by President Jacob Zuma, has dominated elections since 1994. But Rafferty, a local ward councillor, says his community still feels ignored by the ANC and that corruption has delayed the long-promised changes. His party, the Opposition Democratic Alliance, is capitalizing on that frustration in this race.
I think one of the things that we're fundamentally proud of is that we will give them a corruption-free government, because I think that is what people want.
He's one of 60,000 candidates fighting for a seat across the country. Here in the commercial capital of Johannesburg, polls predict the ANC may take a knock because urban voters can see the wide divide between rich and poor up close. The nation's last census found wide racial inequalities. For example, the average mixed-race family brings home about a third of what the average white family does. On average, black families earn even less, about one-sixth. But the ANC still has widespread support, in particular among black South Africans. The ANC has lost voters to the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters, a relatively new party which appeals to youth. The opposition parties have pounded the ANC over a barrage of corruption scandals this year, even calling for Zuma's impeachment.
I just think that South Africa needs a stronger opposition party. I mean, it's just better for politics. It's better to have some competition. And a monopolistic political system isn't really conducive to anything good, I say.
Unlike the ANC, the DA says it doesn't want to rule for a lifetime.
We're the only party that says, just give us this one chance to show you that this is what we can deliver.
Voters will make that call. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Liberia, a former associate of former President Charles Taylor has declared his candidacy for the country's 2017 presidential election. Businessman Benoni Ure says he wants to be president to improve the living condition of all Liberians. He also said his presidency will unite Liberians while fighting corruption.
The situation in our country necessitates that I run. Our people are in abject poverty. The country is on a decline. The people are hungry. We lack medical care. The people lack food to eat. Schools are at its worst. There's a need for a leader. We need a strong leader. We need someone who will say enough is enough. And I believe the people of Liberia believe that I am the one.
So what makes you think is you can do that for Liberia?
Because primarily I've been with the Liberian people all along. I've been with them through war. I've been with them through peace. I've been with them through the best of times. I've been through with them at the worst. And I believe the majority of Liberian people will accept me more than the 20 or more people that believe they can run for the presidency.
You talk about you have 20 or more people running, and the complaint I hear is that there are too many political parties and too many candidates. I hear also that the vice president of Liberia will run to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Is your party willing or open to any talks, coalition, say with the vice president, with any other party?
Well, let me say one thing, James. To have 20 some more parties running for one position is a clear example of a failed state. To answer the second question about coalition, yes, definitely. I'm open to a coalition, but certainly not one with this government, with Unity Party, because we are diametrically opposed. We don't stand for the same thing. I'm anti-corruption. You know, I'm for development. I'm for my people. I love my people.
It can be argued that the government is fighting corruption now because, see, the Global Witness report and how the government has set up a task force, we can say they are fighting corruption now.
Well, to be honest with you, I must commend the president. At least she has made this bold step. You see, I am not anti-government, but I'm anti what is happening in Liberia. But we must be cognizant of one thing. Global Witness still have not shown us the $3 billion that they said Taylor left. So I'm saying these people lack credibility.
Now, back to the election, Mr. Ure. I talked the other day with the election commission chair, and he mentioned that his commission would like to introduce the biometric system in the 2017 election, but he says the government says it does not have the money. Well, what do you think? Would you like a biometric system, or do you think the old system is okay?
The biometric system is definitely more secure than the old system. But what we would not accept under no condition is a biometric system from the Minister of Internal Affairs. The Minister of Internal Affairs is actively running to be George Boka's vice president, and he was appointed by the president. A biometric system under them will not be accepted for this election. And I want to send this word out to the government. If this is what they plan, they must just forget it. We will not have it in Liberia.
Benoni Ure is the leader of the All Liberian Party. I spoke with him during my recent trip to Liberia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 2nd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanewsblog.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela in Nigeria, and Kisi FM in Tanzania. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association General Secretary Victor Menta Mendada was arrested on Monday at the Harare Magistrates Court, where his organization's national spokesman Douglas Mejia was being arraigned on charges of insulting or undermining the authority of President Robert Mugabe. Thomas Chiripasi has the details.
Matema Danda was arrested by heavily armed police details as he walked out of the courtroom where Mahia's case was being heard. Police officers whisked him away to some offices at the court building while ordering all the people, mainly war veterans and civil society activists who were getting out of the courtroom, to leave the place. At the entrance of the court building, some war veterans and civil society activists sang revolutionary songs in solidarity with Matema Danda and Mahia, while some were crying. The police details then used the prisoner's entrance at the back of the court building to exit with Matema Danda and sped off as the singing former freedom fighters were approaching the vehicle that was being used by the police to whisk Matema Danda away. Matema Danda's attorney, Beatrice Mutetwa, told Studio 7 by phone from Harare Central Police Station that her client was being held at the station, but no formal charges had been leveled against her client. Francis Nando, another top war veteran, was also arrested. There were no details of his whereabouts. He is linked to a damning communique issued by war veterans last week, which condemned President Mugabe for running down Zimbabwe. At the same time, Magistrate Vakai Chikwekwe granted Mahia a $300 bail and ordered him to report twice per week at Harare Central Police Station's Law and Order Division until the matter was finalized. Meanwhile, war veterans chairperson Chris Muchangwa, who was also at the courts, criticized the arrest of former freedom fighters.
It said that these heroic fighters, the best army Africa has ever produced in modern times, 4 decades down the line, they are just being persecuted by those who were war deserters, those who were war cowards. Some of them was at school with them. They didn't go to war, but they are now very powerful, and they are part of the harassment of the war veterans.
Also at the courts was former vice president and leader of the Zimbabwe People First Party, Joyce Mujuru, who echoed Muchangwa's sentiments.
It's just unfair. That's why you have heard, you have seen people, they are trying to show that the way things are going is not the correct way. And I think I've been talking about it, that we don't have to show any hard-handedness.
Several human rights activists and politicians, including one of MDCT leader Morgan Tsvangirai's deputies, Nelson Chamisa, attended the court session. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
A professor of political science says Ethiopia finds itself at a crossroads with an uncertain future unless the government holds free and fair elections. This as tens of thousands of people in Gonda, the Amhara region of northern Ethiopia, protested Sunday calling for a change of government due to unfair distribution of wealth in the country. Professor Getachew Metefera says the protest in Gonda and the one in Oromia last year have their roots in the Ethiopian government's policies and what some Ethiopian groups feel is the lack of representation.
The first one, I think, is what is called the Kilil. That is ethnic-based federalism that has created a dichotomous situation, let's say, between the Amharas and Oromos, the Oromos and the Tigrayans. The second, I think, is the expansion of the territory of the Tigray people, the Tigray region, which has expanded to include an area called Wolqayte Trgede in the Gondar region where the uprising is taking place now. The people in Wolqayte Trgede, they say that, rightly, that they are Amharas and not Tigrayans, so they should not be incorporated in the Tigray region. Another thing I can add, the third one, is the land grabbing. For example, in the Gambela region, in the southern region, in the western and southern part of Ethiopia. Another thing, the fourth reason I can give is the situation of democracy itself is seriously worsening. There is no human rights protection, human rights abuses. There is no freedom of speech, freedom of the press. So these are the root causes of the situation taking place in Gondar because people seem to be fed up. And they are challenging the government.
As you mentioned, Ethiopia is at a crossroads. There were protests last year and earlier this year, the Oromia people. Is there a connection between the Oromia protests and the Gondar protests now?
There was a disconnection, but now they have connected. Actually, the slogans in Gondar now, it says that the rights of the Oromo people need to be upheld. So they have joined, they have linked. Not only the Oromos and the Amharas, the other subjugated and disenfranchised Ethiopians will also join in this situation.
You talk about the Ethiopian government, but these days countries are concerned about protests like this being influenced by anti-government groups or terrorists. So you can understand, you mentioned the government arresting people. Do you understand the government's point of view also?
Yes, I do. Unfortunately, any semblance of resistance will be tied to terrorism. So they are giving that false statement by saying that any kind of call for democratic rights, basically the government will tie guerrilla force or Islamic fundamentalism. And so that has become a scapegoat, which the Western countries are buying it.
How do you think, Professor, can Ethiopia quench this flame of uprising? What can the government do?
Well, the government has to open up. Democracy, not false democracy, true democracy has to reign, not false election, true election. How do you expect a government claiming 100% seat in the parliament in spite of this uprising and opposition? Opposition leaders are silenced, are in prison. So with that kind of situation, there could not be peace and stability in the country.
Getachew Metefera is professor of political science at Morgan State University in the state of Maryland. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. 2 years ago, protests and rioting rocked the U.S. city of Ferguson in Missouri following the shooting death of an unarmed 18-year-old black man by a white police officer. The events led to an investigation into the Ferguson police and judicial system that uncovered discrimination against African Americans. Earlier this year, the city agreed with the U.S. Justice Department to reform the police department. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from Ferguson on a community still healing while trying to resolve long-standing problems.
There were days of violence.
Hands up! Don't shoot!
Angry protests against police in Ferguson, Missouri 2 years ago.
My neighborhood, my community that I have been, like I said, that I have lived in for 18 years, looked like a scene from Iraq.
There's just a line of police officers, and they've got full riot gear on. They've got their guns pointed at us. And immediately you saw, like, all the women and kids went to the side, and all the young guys and all the young people, like the teenagers, they just stood up and, like, they held their ground.
The violence was sparked after Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson fatally shot unarmed Michael Brown during a street confrontation. There was more unrest after the officer was not charged with any crime. Michael Brown's mother cannot accept the officer's actions.
What he did was a disrespect to the people that honored that uniform and that badge. He put more than just a city in danger. He put more officers in danger. And I'm speaking of the person that held the gun that day.
The shooting fueled the national Black Lives Matter movement and a nationwide debate over police brutality and criminal justice reforms. It also exposed years of police misconduct.
There's always a tension and an uneasiness and an uncertainty around the interaction and the relational nature of individuals and the police, understanding that it is not isolated to merely Ferguson, but the region.
A federal investigation found the mostly white Ferguson Police Department systematically engaged in racial profiling and excessive use of force.
What we still have is a large-scale system that remains suppressive, remains non-responsive. It still is under mandate.
We've worked really hard to try to change the perception of how we do policing here in Ferguson.
DeCarlin Seawood is Ferguson's city manager.
You're not going to fix years and years of issues and a single gunshot. I mean, it's going to take a long, drawn-out process. It's going to take being diligent to make sure that we are standing behind the processes and the procedures that we're putting in place.
So help me God.
The department has a new black police chief, along with requirements for new officer training. Some in the community are skeptical.
It's the same officers. They haven't been retrained. They don't have a good understanding of what neighborhood or community policing would look like because they're not receiving that training.
Emily Davis and other members of the Ferguson Collaborative are helping craft solutions and pressure city officials to carry out Justice Department mandates for the police department.
The citizens have to take on the responsibility of making sure that those agreements are enforced, and we do that by protesting, by bringing to light things that we see that aren't supposed to be.
One thing everyone can agree on, it will take time to fully reform the Ferguson Police Department. African Americans here say that reform starts with serving the community with respect and fairness. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Ferguson, Missouri.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The U.S. military has conducted airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Libya, the Pentagon said on Monday. The strikes were conducted in the Islamic State stronghold of Sirte at the request of the UN-backed Libyan Government of National Accord, according to U.S. and Libyan officials. And that is it for this Tuesday, August 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Eleanor Modu discusses sports medicine. What are the medical principles related to sports? For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.